Welcome to Innovation and Leadership. I'm Jess Larson. On this episode, we get to have repeat guest Rob Finley. If you didn't catch the first time he was on, he's a real estate genius, incredible investor, and also very big in prop tech. Rob's got a new book out called Beyond the Building, and we're excited to have him back. Rob, thanks for doing this.
Hey, Jess, thank you so much for having me. It's always such an honor and pleasure to be here. So thank you.
Yeah, you bet. So just for people who missed the episode a couple of years ago, can you give people just a sense of scale of like, just, you know, you don't have to overshare, but like give them a sense of scale of like how much real estate you got in and how big the prop tech and those other businesses got?
Sure. Well, I've been in this business for a long time. I actually grew up in the real estate space. My dad was a broker and property manager and then became a developer and so on. So I've been in commercial real estate my entire life. But right now, my company at 30 Capital, we have everything from apartments to office to a lot of securitized debt. That tends to be our sort of our bread and butter. We invest as a directly into deals. We also are co-GPs. We're also passive investors in some deals. So our breadth is pretty large in terms of actual real estate investment and ownership. But in addition to that, we're also a technology company. We're very big in the capital markets space as well. People probably know me from my first company called DeFees with Ease. So anybody who's been involved in a DeFeasance was probably heard of us or has been to our website. But we also do a lot of derivatives, hedging, debt optimization, and debt advisory for people as well. But the technology, you're absolutely right. PropTech, for the past 20 years, I've built and sold five companies in the prop tech or some of that property specific space. So
yeah, so great. Well, let's talk about the book for people who haven't seen it yet. Tell them what it's about.
Yeah, so Beyond the Building is really a collection of a couple of things. So the real focus of the book is to give owners of real estate a playbook and a framework that they can utilize to increase enterprise value. Find opportunities around the corner and really spot trends and create a real different environment, a real different business for themselves. And what I've done is over the last 20 years, as I said, I've been in this space. I have had the benefit of being able to meet real change experts in the space, right? Real innovators in terms of real estate, right? People who have done things just differently. And I think the one thing that has always I've sort of paid attention to is a lot of the people who have been very successful in operating commercial real estate operate a business that's more like a technology company whose product is real estate and not necessarily a real estate company or just specifically the real estate. And so the book is about this framework, as I said, that's really going to help people become change agents, but by operating their business more like a technology company and less like a real estate company.
Yeah. I'm interested, you know, after doing hundreds of millions of dollars of business, what was that process like to boil it down to some more simple things that people can implement?
Well, I think it starts out, there's a couple of things. I think the first and foremost thing is in order to effectuate change, you yourself as the leader of an organization have to change, right? And I think right now we're starting to see it because in the past 10 years, the real estate game has always been on the buy, right? I buy a couple of years, I do this thing and I sell. And you can get away with that when interest rates are practically zero, rental rates are going up and inflation is pretty much in check. Now, all of a sudden, people have to look at this and say, wait a second, interest rates are up, inflation is up, supply is real, and now I really have to run and operate properties. I have to be known as being a really good operator. And now it starts with how do you as an operator change your business, change your mindset, really create alpha. As I said, alpha was on the buy. Now it's on the operations. So what are you doing differently than everybody else in order to be better? And that's where it starts. That's where the framework starts is leadership. Then it comes into planning, getting the team around you, consensus building, finding the right direction, implementing a plan, understanding the right customers, And most important is really utilizing data and analytics and really believing in innovation to make this change.
Yeah. And, you know, for any of our friends who are not in the capital markets world, can we talk a little bit about alpha and beta for a second?
I'm going to give
a really bad explanation. I want you to give better ones, okay?
I'll just give you alpha is really the incremental difference that you make because of you, right? It's like alpha is really about the value. Like you could, I could go invest in treasuries and make 5%, but I'm going to go invest in something that is substantially maybe a little more risky or less risky, whatever it is, but it's the incremental return that I make because of my expertise, because my decision-making abilities, because the way I can operate a property. And I think that's really important because this business in all of real estate is sort of lack transparency, right? And people will say, hey, I'm the best operator in the world. Well, prove it. How do you prove it? What have you done? And I think by having a framework around you and real data and analytics, it's important to see, you can actually see who's actually better. Right, I can go into a market, I can look at one of your properties and I can look at five others and I can tell you how you operate that property compared to those five others. Are you in the top quartile in terms of, operations, or are you the bottom? And so it's really utilizing, really being able to produce better returns with the same thing.
Yeah. So let's talk about examples of identifying things that maybe not everyone's, not all of my competitors are doing in my real estate asset class.
Well, I think there's a lot of things, right? And I think this, you have to step back, and I come back to this understanding the framework, right? Understanding operating a real estate company, right? Like a technology company whose product is real estate. So let's look at that, right? Think about this. It's understanding who's your customer, right? And this is a really big thing of understanding who is your customer. And a lot of people will say, oh, well, my residents are my customer, or my employees are my customer, or my investors are my customer. In reality, everybody is your customer, right? Your investors, your tenants, your residents, your employees, everybody around you, your brokers, your all that stuff. And so how do you engage and work with them is one way to create alpha. And one of the things I would actually say to that is I equate enterprise value of an organization by the value of all their customers. So there's things like that. And that's an easy way to get in there and maximize your relationship with your customers and how they feel about you.
Yeah. By the way, we need to give a shout out to our mutual friend, Josh Steinle, who got us together.
Yes, absolutely, Josh.
Josh is so great. Yep. So my real estate fund, we've got short-term rental, right? And there's some exciting things. There's some heartache when people take too much debt and do some silly things, when you look at the space, as it's, continually evolved in the last number of years, there's so many people that think like, oh, I'll just put up some TPs, or I'll just put a tiny house cabin, or I'll just do this and it'll be fine. And like you said, when debt is free, interest rates are in check and demand is climbing, yeah, you can probably just throw spaghetti at the wall and something's going to stick. And that's not the world we live in anymore. If you were talking to short-term rental operators, what are some of the initial questions? What are some of maybe the spots that maybe our competition aren't thinking about?
So I think when you look at short-term rental, right? So are you talking about specifically sort of that kind of like Airbnb type short-term rental?
Specifically like the destination. Now, hey, these are the glamping tents outside the national park. This is the tiny house by the snowboarding skiing mountain, or the surf beach, kind of that destination. I want something more special than a hotel, but anyways, go ahead.
Yeah, I think we look at a lot of things, right? It comes down to, so part of a somebody that I'm giving money to invest, right? So, I mean, in reality, you're not necessarily a real estate owner operator, right? You're an investment advisor, right? I'm coming to you because I am giving you money of mine, and you need to invest it for me. And so the things that I would ask you specifically are, how do you look at the asset, not just from a property level, but from the capital stack as well? Right. You mentioned it very clearly. Yes, people went and got 90% LTV deals and on a three cap, and they're able to finance it at a 0.5% interest rate and did it uncapped. And they were heroes when they did it, and now they're in trouble. I think one of the biggest points that I'd like people to take away is, and when we do talk about this alpha question, is the real estate in most transactions is only one part of the equation. The debt is an equal and important aspect that goes into the return metrics. And so when we go back to this point about alpha, creating alpha returns isn't just about, hey, I was able to buy this properly and increase the rent and do this, and I put in 20 units, but also how do you optimize the debt? And I think one of the first things that we typically do when we look to invest with somebody is understand the strengths and weaknesses of who we invest with. Hey, this is a really good, this person knows these high-end destination short-term rentals. They know this space. They know the market. They know how many units they need. They know how to get the people. They know how to appeal on social media. Great. But do you have the other side of it? Do you know how to properly optimize your debt on that? How are you going to finance this thing, right? How are the markets looking at this? Are you really, are you really going to be able to get, you're going to need to have probably 2 years of good operating history before somebody's going to finance you. So I have short-term interest rate risk that I want to look at. So those are the things that we would look, and I would ask you, how do you think about debt in this asset?
Well, my main focus these days is our biotech VC fund, but the team that runs more of the real estate fund for me, like, I'm kind of a chicken right now. Like, I look at a bull market that, we had a little COVID blip, but we kind of haven't had a real recession in like 14 years or something. And I'm a big Howard Marks, Warren Buffett fan that at some point the pendulum swings the other way. So we're just doing like non-traditional building materials we're doing some robots and some stuff for construction. So we don't have to pay typical labor. So our whole strategy is like, can we just build these things at half price? Can we build a $140,000 tiny house cabin for half price and not take any debt to begin with? So for right now, until we have operating history, until there's either a recession or there isn't or something, we're actually just not taking debt to begin with. And it hurts our returns, but I just don't have a crystal ball right now.
Yeah. Well, I think that comes back to it. I think one of the misnomers is, interest rates have always been relatively high relative to where they are today, right? I mean, it's just like people are like, oh my gosh, it's treasuries. Well, I remember when treasuries were 7-8%. I think what I look at is that it's a function of the market, right? Because valuations and interest rates and all that stuff, they sort of go hand in hand. But looking at a properly levered situation is good, right? I mean, it is part of the equation. As I said, it's part of the equation. If you want to create alpha, yep, you can take a much better approach and risk-free rate. I'm going to go build tiny homes and not have them levered. It's a great, by the way.
Well, just to begin with, until we know what we're doing, then maybe we optimize as it goes on.
Sure, sure. So, but back to your original question, what do I look at with tiny homes? Market, right? Is there a market for it? Is there a real market for it? And do these guys have the ability to draw, which is draw in the people? How good is their social media? Because most short-term rentals come in from social media and not from your traditional apartments.com or some of the Craigslist, right? So how good are they at social media? And those would be the things that I would look at, right?
Yeah, that makes lots of sense. For people who don't understand or just haven't been in commercial real estate, can you explain this concept that it's not like a house mortgage where you get a 30-year mortgage and that's the one time you do it? Can you talk about rolling over debt and when your building price goes down and debt prices go up and how people get squeezed?
Yeah, I think, I'm a big believer in optimizing debt. I'm a big believer in debt. Appropriate leverage is key for ultimate returns in real estate, just period, end of story. But there is complexity which makes it difficult, right? And I never cease to wonder and is that there's a tremendous amount of comfort. I can talk to any real estate person and they can get into the nitty gritty about every deal and every municipality and every unit and how this unit's going to turn and it's going to be $50 for this. But when you start talking about caps, swaps, derivative products, prepayment penalties, and the complexity of the debt, how quickly they sort of come inside and say, wait a second, that's not really what we do. We just get long-term debt and we go. And so back in commercial real estate, one of the exciting things about commercial real estate is that there are a myriad of structures. And the structures can be from very simple, like I'm going to go get a 10-year loan, 30-year amortization from Fannie or Freddie or from my bank, and it's going to be, you know, whatever debt service coverage ratio, and I'm going to have it, and it's going to have either a fixed prepayment or some type of yield maintenance or a defeasance, right? And that's plain vanilla, and I'm going to keep it, I'm going to hold it in place for 10 years or however long, or I'm going to go to HUD and get a 30-year deal. Or you can get into short-term deals. You can get into short-term interest only. And so there's a whole different world behind the debt products that I think real estate people should understand. They should understand the capital markets. If you're going to borrow money, just like if you're going to buy a real estate piece of property, you should really know the market. You should really know the market on the debt as well.
Yeah, you know, my mentor of the last 22 years, like right when I started pretending to be an adult, he was John Rehassin, partner in the real estate fund. And like, yeah, he came out of real estate family. He's owned his own properties, you know, resorts in the Rocky Mountains and retail and industrial, all sorts of stuff. But, you know, he's been operating since the late 80s. And mm-hmm. I'm just shocked at what having good relationships with his bankers and spending the time on what you're talking about, how he is like, you know, dot-com bubble, 08, COVID. Like, he's just like, because that's not my strength. And so I'm so lucky to be partnered with him. But like, I'm shocked when I'm like, oh man, everybody's so screwed right now. But he's like, he understands what you're talking about. He's got great relationships with his lenders. And It's just amazing how he hasn't been taken out with so many others can. And so, while I'm not good at what you're saying, I appreciate it.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying, look, it is a complex world. Make no qualms about it. And quite frankly, you know, until the music runs out, you didn't have to, right? I mean, when interest rates are zero and, you know, borrowing rates and everybody's aggressive, you don't really need to know about it. You do. I think what's important now is saying, okay, yep, I've learned a lesson. Okay, let me understand this understanding of the between perception and reality on interest rates. Remember, there are short-term rates, there are long-term rates. And right now, the short-term rates are higher yielding than the long-term rates, right? We have this inverted yield curve. And so people are thinking, and the two are disconnected. They don't necessarily move, you know, at the same slope. And so people who have this sort of, hey, let's just hope that interest rates go down. You know, hey, I'll be okay because they say, the Fed is saying that they're going to drop rates, or the market is showing that rates are going to come down. But in reality, if you looked 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, the market was pricing in that the Federal Reserve was going to cut rates 7 times. That's how they were pricing it. But yet the Fed themselves were saying, hey, if you look at our dot plot, we're only predicting to drop 3 times. So clearly there's an imbalance. And so people who can take those two basic pieces of information and distill it and make a common sense decision are going to be okay.
Okay, can we talk about investor psychology? Because you're such a skilled investor. There's such a human, I mean, you know, in general, most entrepreneurs, most investors have some element of optimism, right? This concept of like radical self-honesty and like becoming objective, when we have like this human characteristic to believe in a future that we hope happens, mm-hmm. When you think about overcoming that within yourself, or advice for the rest of us to not overbelieve in something just because we hope it'll turn out that way, and to help ourselves become even more objective. Do you have any thoughts?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Look, this is where data and analytics are key to innovation and to, if you look at the book, I mean, by Beyond the Building, right? Innovation is all about accepting and embracing those things. Right. And you think about this, you talk about the investor psychology. You know, I'm always reminded of one of my favorite stories, Blockbuster and Netflix. Right. So Blockbuster, you know, you had to go to Blockbuster, you had to go drive your car, you had to go see if the video was there, and if it was there, you were lucky, and then you'd have to go rewind it. Then along came Netflix. And it was starting, right? There was real data and analytics that was presented to the board of directors of Blockbuster, and they said, hey, wait a second, these guys are getting user share and they're doing this, and this is something we should be thinking about. And by the way, we could actually buy Netflix for $30 million. And the board of Blockbuster, and to their detriment, said, no, we are on the right path. We have year-over-year sales growth. We have year-over-year user growth. We have year-over-year, and we're doing just fine. And our stockholders love us. They wouldn't want this because this, and this, right? And they were able to believe that that was the right way. And look what happened. I mean, the whole industry, all these industries are filled with that sort of that psychology of, I'm going to do things the way that I've done it before, and I'm going to be optimistic. And yes, to be an entrepreneur, you do have to be optimistic. Otherwise, you wouldn't get up, right? I mean, it's too hard, right? Owning real estate is too hard. Starting your business is too hard. If you weren't optimistic, you shouldn't be doing it, right? But it's about taking data and analytics in, being smart, understanding what's going on, and being able to make these correct decisions based upon fact and not just sort of theory.
Yeah. That's great. Well, tell us another one of your favorite stories or principles from the book.
Well, I think there's a lot of them, right? I think there's a lot of situations where people come to me and they say, well, innovation is all about technology, Rob. I don't want to, you know, you've got all these things like AI now, and, you know, and all this other stuff, and AI is going to change the world and all that stuff. And yeah, AI is very powerful. And I would tell every one of your listeners, if you don't truly understand the power of AI right now, do yourself a favor, go on Udemy or go on some, you know, some class and take a, you know, 5-part class and understand what it's going to do and what it can do and what it can't do. Because a lot of times people are sort of this misnomer of, oh, all I need to do is use AI and I'm going to rule the world. Not quite, but it's understanding the reality. But it's not all about technology. It's about doing things differently. It's about seeing and pulling in things that make sense in other businesses and utilizing it in my own business. And I think that's really what it's all about. There are people, you know, value add, for example, right? Value add was a normal sort of concept in this past sort of go around in apartment investing, right? You buy something, you'd fix up a couple of kitchens and a couple of bathrooms, and you'd charge a premium, and you'd say, hey, if you did this for the rest of these units, you're going to make all this money. Well, the value add, there was actually a guy in New Jersey who started really the real value add process. And, you know, this was back in the late 60s, right? People were coming back, and families were now moving out of the city, and they were moving into these more urban areas, but all the apartments were old and they wanted them to be renovated. And so they came through and started to renovate their apartments. And that was sort of the first example of value add. That's just innovation. Yeah. You know, so I think there's so many things about the book that were about people doing things differently. There's, for example, there's a company called Open Path Investments. There's a gentleman by the name of Peter Slough that I mentioned. He utilizes OKRs, objectives and key results. These are planning, these are goal setting and sort of planning strategies that are used by Google and major organizations to really effectuate change. Very powerful things. He started to apply OKRs to his own business and absolutely supercharged his whole business by getting his team aligned and going in a forward direction.
Can we talk about that? So, you know, John Doerr's got that great book, Measure What Matters, right? In your mind, if you were going to explain it simply to people, what's the difference between goals, KPIs, you know, key performance indicators, and OKRs?
Yeah. So the big difference between an objective is the key result, right? So objective, key result. What is it? So the objective is like this big high thing that you want to do. I want to be the greatest provider of, or I want to have the best experience for a overnight guest, right? I want to be known for having this experience, right? Like that's your objective. Well, what's the key result that you're hoping to get for it? I expect my occupancy to be at this level and my daily rate to be at this level, right? So key results are actually key things. Goals are much more open and subjective, right? They're not set in stone like an objective and key result. And I know objectives and goals get sort of looped in at the same point, but objective, purely high level, you know, where do you want to go? And the key result is how I'm going to get there. And then the KPIs are basically along the way saying, yeah, you are getting that way, right? So if you're in your particular case, your key result is I want occupancy to be up here. Well, your KPI is going to be occupancy rate, right? And what's your weekly occupancy? What's your week over week occupancy? What's your season over season occupancies, right? So these KPIs are giving you the individual information that you need to know and to make sure that you're going in the right direction.
That's interesting how, you know, words can be so powerful. And yes, some of it gets down to semantics, but like if I'm understanding you, the way you think about it is like the key performance indicator is what we're measuring all along the way. So we can get this level of key result that we believe will give us the objective where we're like the North Star here. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's a great way to summarize it. You're absolutely right. And these are important because what it does is it aligns your entire team, right? Everybody in your organization. And when you fully implement OKRs, you actually start it at high level and work all the way down. So that in our organization, you know, leasing agents actually have their own set of OKRs, right? And that's really powerful. When everybody's working off of that same North Star and breaking it down, it is an incredibly powerful thing, which is, as I said, which is why, yeah, I mean, you go through all the Google, Netflix, Airbnb, I mean, all of these large, you know, super powerful companies that have been very successful, have really managed change and growth, are utilizing and have you utilized OKRs?
Well, it's something to think about for how many of us, you know, we give our staff standards or metrics to hit. But I think a lot of us in leadership, myself included, don't always spend the time to help them recognize how them hitting this helps the whole company's objective. Like what is, you know, it sounds simple, but like it's so often people don't really know exactly how what they do directly contributes to the North Star of the whole organization, especially the bigger they get, right?
Yep.
And it sounds so simple, but there's a lot of us that need to do more of it.
It's critical. And it really is. And, you know, I didn't really understand OKRs until about 3 or 4 years ago when we started, I had somebody come in the organization in senior leadership and they're like, your company is messed up. Your people have no idea. You're off here going this way and your people are off going this way. And nobody is aligned. Nobody knows who's doing what, what's going on, but yet, hey, we were making money. Things are good. Things are great. And as markets change and companies have to, I don't want to use the word pivot, but the companies have to refocus and adapt to what their needs are. It becomes critical. Right. And that's, I mean, it can happen very quickly. Hey, I'm going this way and everybody's going this way. And all it does is lead to frustration on both sides. So you're absolutely right. A good manager, and that's, you know, leadership is a part of this innovation framework, which is leadership is all about making sure that you understand the direction and can let the team know what direction and understand where their wants and needs are as well. Because employees are customers. You need employees to run your business. So making sure that they're all aligned and feeling a part of it, it is incredibly powerful.
Yeah. You know, it makes me think of another question. You've been in the real estate world for so long and you've seen the ups and downs and you've seen people do very large transactions, maybe, you know, real estate transactions in the hundreds of millions or more. And some of those people aren't around anymore. And then you've seen the people that are able to get to the point where they can, you know, do these very significant transactions and year after year, they're still around and, you know, they get to buy the jets and the boats and the planes, whatever they want. Right. And in your mind, when you think about characteristics in common, these friends of yours who've reached levels of success like yourself, What's some traits you see in common for people being able to play the real estate game at the highest level decade after decade?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it comes down to probably one major theme: they can adapt. I think without question, the most successful people I've seen in real estate adapt. And I think it's, you know, I treat this back to even my father. As I said, my dad, I have a chapter in there and I talk about him, because here's a person who's adapted in real estate based upon the market, right? The market is not static, right? Things change. I mean, you've seen it, you know. 20 years ago, people would never do what you're doing, right? These tiny homes, like these vacation, who would go there, right? It's like, no, I'll go to a KOA, right? Instead of that. But now, realizing like, hey, people actually will go and spend a lot of money, and this is a great experience. So my dad started out in brokerage, commercial brokerage. Then back in the 80s, the market collapsed. And in order for him to sell stuff, he had to go work for the RTC he had his own firm, but the RTC came around and he's like, oh, wait a second, I could be a property manager because transactions are few and far. So I'm going to be a property manager. And then next came, hey, maybe affordable housing. So he got into affordable housing. Then he pivoted to seniors. Then he went back into market rate. And then he went into post offices and retail. And right along his career of 30 plus years, has always, maybe 40 years now, it's always been about adapting, seeing market change. And in order to do that, I think it comes back to the same thing, adapting. The other thing that I found from these great leaders and people who have been in business is their desire to learn. They are constant consumers of information, either, you know, and I call it like data. I think of this stuff. I think of Udemy as data. Learning a class on AI is data. You're just ingesting stuff. And every single one of these people that I've talked to and I looked at that were successful, they all had that trait in common. They were always consuming things. It was consuming books. And it didn't matter. It could be books on marketing technology. It could be books on self-help. It's a book on or a video on this or a class on this. And that's where they became really powerful. They consumed data. They basically became their own BI and AI machine. They would go to every conference and they would listen. You know, you want to see the successful real estate operators, go to these conferences and go look at the people who are sitting in the front couple rows of these conferences, listening to people talking. Those are the ones that you say, that's somebody who wants to consume. They're the ones that look at their notebooks. They're writing down they're underlining. They've got notes. They're asking questions. Those are the people who are successful in this industry, because they realize that they always have something to learn. They always have something that they could be learning. They're humble to know that there is always something that they can learn from somebody else. And that's it. They can adapt and they can learn.
You know, I've said this many times on the podcast, some of like the very best entrepreneurs I've ever had on the show, you know, grown their companies into the multiple billions. I feel like they're like much more humble listeners, and they're listening for what's wrong with their product instead of what's right with it. They're like really curious observers. Like they're looking for what nobody's saying, and they're looking, you know, whether it's data or whether it's like physically seeing people interact, they're looking for stuff that isn't being talked about, that didn't come out, you know, asking questions to their customers or their staff. And then I feel like they spend more time thinking hard, like going away and connecting dots that other people haven't connected, and like having quiet time to themselves instead of being like busy meetings, working 80-hour work weeks. Like there's more like they talk about like going on a walk, like, or bike ride. Like they're regular going on a walk and like don't bring their iPhone with them and stuff like this. And I'm interested on that third part of this concept. So those of us, you know, most of us can get better at reading more, listening more, watching more, learning more. We can spend some more time trying to be more objective in our observations. When you think about taking all that consumption and changing that into learning, you know, like where it's not just a fire hose, we're actually connecting dots. Do you have any thoughts or guidance for how to take all this research and consumption?
I do. And, you know, it's funny. It's actually a game that I play. And I like to teach people how to do this game. And it's about watching and applying, right? So what I do is I say, I don't care. Just do it once a day, twice a day, whatever you can. Watch TV. Go get a video. Go get a, go to Subway or go, you know, and just watch. Just take for one second. Be mindful about what you're doing. Just, you know, not mindfulness, but mindful, right? It's go in and look and just say, wow, really focus on what they're doing. Instead of just having them make your sandwich, how did they take your order? How did they process it? How did they do that? Is there something there that I can apply to my business? Is there something there that I can apply? And that I think is a great, if you just do it as a fun hobby, right? That's just it's sort of a fun hobby I have, which is I go to these places and I do it once or twice. Maybe I do it more than that, but you know, it's constantly learning and expanding your knowledge. I think part of that is also becoming interesting, right? If all you know is one thing, right? I build a widget and I can only talk to you about widgets. You're not a very exciting person. And quite frankly, you would be probably struggling as a business person, right? You need to be able to expand yourself. And I know the younger part of me would have been, I would have struggled to say that because the younger me, when I first started my business, I was 29 years old. I was so focused. It was 24/7 on that business. And it was DeFees with ease. And all I could talk about is DeFees. And so I was the most boring person in the world. Fast forward a few years, I sell the business. And then I'm like, okay, well, what do I do now? I have nothing to do. My day job is gone. So what do? I flew helicopters and planes and raced cars and did all this other stuff. And it gave me a sense of sort of expanding my horizon. Fortunately, I bought DeFees with Ease back and I started other businesses along the way. But it helps put somebody into a better frame. And I think you mentioned something, this mindfulness, going for walks and stuff like that. I think understanding mindfulness is a very, very, very important concept, right? Of being able to sort of energize yourself, take a break, release your brain. Yeah, it is an incredibly powerful thing to not be thinking about work and just actually go take a walk in nature, go look around and go find other things. It's okay to be interesting. It's okay to you know, like science books. It's okay to watch cartoons. It doesn't matter. It's okay to do that. Be a normal human. And you'll find that you'll get the benefit of learning things and taking things and being interested.
I love it. There's this great book called Where Good Ideas Come From by Stephen Johnson that just goes through how many innovations, whether it's like the coffee houses during the Enlightenment, whether it's like Bob Dylan, the music scene in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and like, how often it's these people who are bumping into folks outside of their groupthink and yeah. Then go back and do their stuff and then come out and bump into all these people who they would normally not do that with. Or like the IDEO guys that invented so many things for Apple, for Steve Jobs, like the mouse and making Macs colorful, just these different, like pretty revolutionary things. They say like, go to Barnes & Noble, but go to the magazines you would never normally pick up.
Yeah,
and come and try and bump into something you wouldn't normally bump into, right?
Right.
So,
and that's critical. Think about taking that stuff back to your business, though, right? It's like design. What's the value of packaging and presentation, right? We're in multifamily, right? It's all about experience. Now, your business, right? It's all about experience. What do you do? And if you were talking to people that were designing products for Apple, how exciting is that, right? I mean, they're talking about merchandising and you know, branding. I mean, that's what it's all about.
Yeah. I would love to hear a couple stories. I'd love to hear like one of your entrepreneurial low points, like, you know, one of the toughest times for you, and then maybe one of the wins, one of the highest highs for you.
Yeah, I think the lows, you know, there could be many, right? It's like you can't be an entrepreneur, a serial entrepreneur, and have 100% wins all the time, right? You don't do that. I think one of the ones is, you know, when you actually have to give up on a project, right? When you actually have to say, you know what, even if I, you know, put more money into this, I was not able to be successful. And that's the low part, right? That's a very hard part about being an entrepreneur, where you finally say, you know what, I tried it, I spent a lot of money, I thought my, you know what, doesn't stink. And I was, you know, because I've had these great wins before, I'm great, and everybody tells me I'm great. And then you go into one of these deals and you have to shut down a company. That's hard. That's a low point. You know, and that was probably one of my low points. I had to start a business, put a lot of money into it, believed in it, still believe in it, but wasn't able to make it work, right? So you always, as an entrepreneur, you always blame yourself. It wasn't necessarily the market. It was me. A better operator probably could have made that company successful, right? If I was, yeah, somebody else, I could have done this. So that was definitely the low, right? I had a business that I did that. I think the high for me was actually on my first business. When I sold it, very fortunate, it was a great liquidity event. And I shared that liquidity with a lot of the people who started the business with me. And I think the high point was when I still get cards from this group, and a lot of them have retired, but I still get cards and letters from these people. And they say, thank you, you've changed my life. I know, you know, it happened years ago, but you've changed my life. You gave me a liquidity event that I never thought I could happen. And, you know, we were part of something. And that to me is what it's all about. I think you lose sight of a lot of times you know, as I said, I was very fortunate, sold a couple businesses. They were successful exits. And so money has a very different meaning. Not that I don't like it. I love it. But it's more of, can you help people? Can you do things that are better, right? And that's really when you realize it's not just about you, it's about other people, and it's about your investors, and it's about the people that you've changed lives, employees. That's what it's all about. Those are my highs. Those are absolutely my highs. To watch people grow with me in an organization, my absolute highs. The fact that I still have, I think, probably 10 or 15 people that have worked with me for more than 15 years, that's a high, right? Those are highs for me. So That's what it's all about.
Yeah, that's great. Well, tell us another story from the book.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of stories. I think one of my favorite stories is under leadership, and it's a story about Willie Walker. Willie Walker took over a family business called Walker and Dunlop. Which is Walker Dunlop was when Willie took it over, was a small sort of regional mortgage banking firm, you know, just small regional, and he basically took this over and created one of the a premier organization. I think most people who are in multifamily now know about Willie and Walker Dunlop. But one of the things that really astounded me with Willie was when I first met Willie. I was at the NMHC conference, which is the National Multi-Housing Conference, and a big multi, and it's a sea of blue coats, right? Everybody is wearing their blue blazers or their dark suits, and I'm sitting there, and everybody's trying to figure out who everybody else is, and this guy walks through this conference room in a like bright bicycle outfit. Right? Like just like with the helmet and the guy looks like he's about to go on the Tour de France. Like, who is this guy? And I'm like, you think about it, everybody's in their blue blazers, everybody's, you know, trying to pitch deals, and this guy's walking through with his bike and he's gonna go on a ride. And I'm like, who is this guy? And I finally realized it was Willie Walker. And I think it comes back to that thing. Willie is an incredibly aggressive, phenomenal leader. Willie also has that belief that there's other things outside of just running Walker and Dunlop, right? He loves to exercise. He loves to run. He loves to ski. He loves to all sorts of physical activity. And it was really about this guy who was able to put aside growing and running this massive billion-dollar organization and growing it to that level, but also in the middle of a conference, which for me, I would have fired him, right? If he was one of my guys back then, I would have been like, you're about to go on a bike ride in the middle of this conference, you're fired, you're out of here. Willie was there, and he's going to go do his thing because it makes him better. And he knows that if he went for a bike ride, he went out there and did it, he's going to come back energized, recharged, and ready to go, as opposed to just having these meetings. So it was just a fun, you know, it's just a fun story of how I met him and how I saw him. But it is important, right? You take these things, you tie back. It's important to have these outside outlets to be a better you.
That's so great. If people want to get a hold of the book, is Amazon the best, or where are the best places?
Yeah, Amazon. Yeah, it's Amazon. Amazon is probably the best. Barnes and Noble. You can find it there as well. And so, people can take a look at it. We also, they can go to robfinlay.com and they can also get the book there. I also have I actually created an AI model from the book for OKRs. So if you're a real estate organization, I think it mostly works. I haven't tried it with other organizations, but you can go to your website, cut your domain name, put it into it. And the AI will come in, read your website, tell you what your overview is of your website, what people reading your website will say it is, and then it will create actually a first level of OKRs for you based upon that website. Just so it gets you started, as I said, I believe in OKRs. It gives you a head start to at least think about it and how powerful they are.
Great. That's really fun that you made that. How long ago did you do that?
We just launched it the other day because I get a lot of calls from people, and I love getting calls from people. I love seeing people. I love having people talk to me. I was getting a lot of questions. I was realizing in the book, people were asking more questions about OKRs than they were on data and analytics and, you know, knowing your customers and customer journeys and all that kind of stuff. I'm like, well, geez, I'm getting so many questions on this. Why don't we just take it and do this with it? And so it was just making it easy to do. Plus, it was a fun AI project.
Yeah, no kidding. And as far as following you online, is LinkedIn the best, or where's best?
Yeah, LinkedIn, Instagram. I actually, coming back, I actually like to show the other side of me. So I do have an Instagram where I encourage people to look, because it's. Yeah, one day it could be me. This past weekend, I was building beehives at my farm because it's almost springtime here, and we're gonna have our bees in soon. So I'm building beehives over the weekend. On the other side, you might see me on an interview. You'll see me on this, right? So it's just it's a good way to connect as well.
And where are you located these days? What's the cluster?
Yeah, I basically am East Coast for the most part. I do travel a lot, but I'm in Florida, Charlotte, North Carolina, and in Virginia. So basically travel between the three. The corporate offices are in Charlotte, so I do spend a lot of time there.
How fun. Well, this has been super fun. Thanks for making this happen.
Yeah, no, thank you. As I said, it's always an honor to get on and talk with you. I love, never know where we're going to go, but do enjoy the conversation. So thank you for having me.
You bet. Bye, everyone.